This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, coming to you from the Aspen Ideas Festival here at the Hotel Jerome in Aspen, Colorado. Yeah. Now, back in the day, there was one surefire way to learn something new about the brain. Wait for someone to suffer a serious brain injury, destroy a part of the brain, and then see what goes wrong. That's what happened to Phineas Gage in 1848. Gage was working on the railroad when an explosion drove an iron spike clean through his head. Gage lived, and doctors learned a few useful things about what the brain's frontal lobe did. Or take the guy known as H.M. In the 1950s, H.M.'s hippocampus was surgically removed in an attempt to cure his epilepsy. Back then, no one really knew what that seahorse-shaped bundle of neurons did until they realized H.M. couldn't form any new memories. Now in this age of fMRI studies, you might think that stories of holes through the head wouldn't be too important anymore. My next guest says, not so fast. Half a century after H.M., neuroscience is still learning from brains gone wrong. Sam Keen is a science writer. His latest book is The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons, The History of the Human Brain, as revealed by true stories of trauma, madness, and recovery. We'll ask him about some of those brains gone wrong. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. If we have such sophisticated ways of looking at the brain, looking at brain functions in normal and in healthy people, is it still useful today to look for brain injuries as ways of studying the brain?
Yeah, it's definitely still useful because what you're basically doing is you're taking part of the brain offline. You're removing it, you're disabling it in some way, and just seeing what happens to people afterward. And really, all of the major discoveries in the history of neuroscience for a long, long time, centuries, came about because of these people who had these injuries. And then you would see, you know, parents couldn't recognize their children anymore. They'd turn into pathological liars or whatever. And then it would give you a clue about what that part of the brain did.
Tell us about the fabled Phineas Gage, because most people know about him. What's the truth?
The fabled Phineas Gage, I think, is the apropos word there. Most people have heard about Phineas Gage from psychology books, neuroscience classes, whatever. He was a railroad worker in Vermont in the 1840s. He was tamping down some gunpowder one day, trying to blow a rock apart, and a spark went off. He was using a very long iron rod, and it basically exploded upward, entered below his cheekbone, flew out the top of his head, and he ended up blowing out basically his entire frontal lobes. And the amazing thing was he recovered from this injury. There are reports he didn't even lose consciousness afterward. He just fell over. Yeah. They brought him to a doctor. He had an infection. A few days later, he almost died, but he ended up living after this amazingly horrific injury.
So what we hear stories about his personality change. What's the mythology? What's the truth about
it? So the basic story is that his personality changed afterward. He was very important for the history of neuroscience because he was the first clear-cut case of someone whose personality changed. And we know that his personality did change, but it's unclear what exactly happened. If you look back at the original case notes, there are some vague symptoms describing how he might have changed, but there's no evidence that the things you hear about him nowadays, that he became like this drunken lout, a beggar, a brawler, there's basically no evidence for any of those things. And in fact, there's some evidence, if you look at his life history, that he recovered somewhat afterward. He never became the old Phineas Gage, certainly, but it is kind of this message of hope that, you know, if even Phineas Gage might have gotten somewhat better, that, you know, the brain can really go through a lot. It's really an amazingly resilient organ.
Yeah, we think of it now more as plastic than we used to.
Yeah, oh, definitely, definitely.
You know, a lot of people are always talking about what makes humans different is our consciousness. Mm-hmm. Tell us about Clive.
Clive is probably the most profound amnesiac that neuroscience has ever seen. He was a British person living in London in the early 1980s, came down with an infection of what's called the herpes virus. It's related to the virus that gives you cold sores, so not to throw any panic into anyone in the audience, but they sometimes go rogue, the little virus. They go up your olfactory nerve. And when they reach the brain, they wreak a lot of havoc. They destroy everything they come across.
And I hate it when that happens.
Yeah. And he woke up with very profound amnesia. And doctors have seen other cases of amnesia, but what's interesting about Clive is that, especially at the beginning, he seemed to have this thing where his consciousness was kind of coming on, like flipping on almost over and over. And it's not like he was actually unconscious. It was just that he couldn't remember anything about his past. So every single moment for him was like the very first moment he'd ever been alive. So it was like this epiphany he would get over and over and over every single day of his life.
So every time the same thing happened, he thought it was the first time.
And he would grab his diary and he would record, like, now I am completely finally awake. Then 10 minutes later, the epiphany would happen again. He would grab his diary, cross the old entry out, because obviously that was false, because now was the first time he was conscious. Go and write it in, and then 10 minutes later, the same thing would happen over and over. He just had pages filled, just crossing it out 10 minutes after 10 minutes, over and over and over.
Now we have actually, I have a little bit of a clip of Clive himself. We're going to hear him speak about his illness, and then you're going to hear, especially when his wife, Deborah, walks into the room, says, listen to what happens.
I've never seen a human being before, never had a dream or a thought. The brain has been totally inactive, day and night the same. No thoughts at all. As far as I'm concerned, the doctors have been totally incompetent. I've never seen a doctor the whole time. Oh, look, it's come. Oh,
you're wonderful. And that happened every time his wife walked into the room?
Sometimes multiple times in a day. She would go to the bathroom, she would come back, and he would just erupt in joy every time she came. And, you know, it's kind of sweet and endearing on the one hand, but, you know, she admitted it was kind of hard to fake enthusiasm the 20th time that it happened.
Easy for you to say. Yeah. But he did love her. He did talk about, he did know who she was.
Yeah.
And he remembered that he did love her, right?
That was one of the amazing things was, with his memory gone, with his consciousness kind of going on the blink at the beginning like that, he didn't feel like himself. He felt like he was sort of, he wasn't himself anymore. It was very scary for him. But there were a few things that would kind of bring him back to himself. One was his love for his wife. Every time she came, he kind of felt like himself a little bit again. Another thing was that he was a musician, very well-known musician, and he could still sight read because that's a muscle memory, a motor memory stored in a different part of the brain than he suffered damage in. And he could still sight read and play music fine. So he would sit down at the piano, he would start playing, and something about the momentum of the music, the phrasing of the music would kind of bring him back to himself. Mm-hmm. So the old Clive was in there somewhere. It just wasn't always available except for in these very special, interesting, intimate moments.
So the sense of self is very tenacious. It's even hard to kill it off in Clive's situation.
In a lot of cases, people lose all of their language. They lose all of their memory. Their consciousness goes on the blink. But somewhere inside them, they're still themselves deep down. I mean, their lives are certainly not the way they used to be, but the sense of self is something pretty tenacious.
Huh. I think the most interesting part of your book, and we're talking to Sam Keen, author of The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons, is the case in your book of someone who is unable to recognize plants.
There, you see people sometimes where they get damaged in one very specific part of the brain, and suddenly they have trouble recognizing all plants.
But they could still recognize people.
People's faces, no problem. Animals, they're okay with. But plants, they can't recognize. Or you see other people who can't recognize animals, where they can do plants.
Do we know why that is?
The thinking is that we have some sort of circuitry in our brain that's probably specialized for recognizing plants and animals because they've been very important to the history of human beings. You know, we eat animals, we raise them. Some animals are dangerous, same thing with plants. So we probably have some sort of circuitry to help us recognize these things. But kind of the downside of having specialized circuitry is that if it gets damaged, then that knowledge can kind of just poof, disappear out of your mind.
Yeah. Yeah. Your book also talks about how people recover from brain mm-hmm. injuries, and specifically the case of James Holman. That's fascinating.
It was. So James Holman was probably the most prolific traveler the world had ever seen when he was alive, early 1800s, 1820s or so. Ended up traveling something like 250,000 miles, which at the time is incredible. It's like going to the moon, basically. And he did it all while he was completely blind. What he would do is he had a cane, but he didn't use it like blind people today use a cane to kind of feel his way around. He would actually take and he would strike it on the ground and it would make echoes. And he would listen for the echoes and he would know, okay, there's a door there because of the way the sounds were coming back to him. But he got bored just sitting around in like a building, and he would go out and climb. He climbed Mount Vesuvius in mid-eruption. He was hunting down slave traders. He was running sugar across the Atlantic Ocean. He was just doing all these incredible things, completely blind the whole time. And what I talk about a little bit in the book is there are people nowadays who do these kind of things. They make tongue clicks, usually.
Tongue clicks.
Yeah, they make little clicks with their tongue. I can't.
It's not like a...
A little bit like that.
Is that like a bat echolocating?
It is exactly like a bat echolocating. And when they put these people in brain scans and look what's going on in their mind, in their brain, I should say, the incredible thing is that often the visual cortex, the visual parts of their brain, will show activity. So basically they've been recruited, even though the information's coming in through their ears, it's been recruited to help them navigate around. So that part of the brain just doesn't sit idle. It actually gets used for something in a lot of these cases.
You talk about a guy named Daniel Kish, who can actually, even though he's blind, he can bicycle through traffic doing this?
He bikes, climbs trees, dances, does all these kind of things, basically making little clicks while he's moving around, yeah.
Hmm. So after you've gone through all these cases, did you find the brain more fragile or more resilient than you thought?
It's a little bit of a mix of both, because you see all the things that can go wrong, and you start to think, oh my God, like I'm going to wear a helmet everywhere I go. Like I'm never, ever going to leave the house.
Yeah, med
this.
Student syndrome.
Right. Yeah, you start to analyze your own brain like that. But when you start to read about these people's lives, you see that in a lot of cases, they really did lead rich lives. Even when their memory disappeared or language disappeared or something like that, they still led fulfilling lives. So there is a sense you get of that these people, you know, they were genuine people, and you get to know a little bit more about them. And you do get a sense that the brain is this amazing, resilient organ that can, if not recover, at least, you know, give you some compensation, get around those problems in a lot of cases.
Fascinating stuff, Sam. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
All right, thank you.
Sam Keen is a science writer whose latest book is The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons. He joins us here live at the Aspen Ideas Festival. We'll have to take a break. We'll be right back with more from the Aspen Ideas Festival in a moment. One of the most difficult things to buy is a mattress, right? Lying on a bed for 4 minutes in a showroom is not very convincing. And you can pay a lot of money for that mattress. Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses, has a better idea. Casper is revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing the savings on to you. That's why Casper offers a 100-day risk-free trial and painless return policy. Their mattresses are obsessively engineered, too. Two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, come together for just the right sink and just the right bounce. Casper mattresses are made in America and outstandingly priced. $500 for a twin-size mattress, $950 for a king-size. And today, you can save an additional $50. Go to casper.com/scifry and insert the promo code SCIFRY. Casper mattresses for better nights and better mornings. This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flato here at the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. I want you to think back to your math class, in middle school or thereabouts, and was it a joyous, mind-expanding experience? Yeah? Well, you're lucky. It could have been something like this.
The problem was this. What is the ratio between 4.5 yards and 1.5 feet? Now, you looked hurriedly at 4.5 and 1.5, said the answer was 3. Well, that's where you fell into a trap. What you forgot was that before you can divide, you have to reduce all units of measurement to the same unit. Now, what's the unit here?
Me?
That's right.
By golly, I sure fell for that one.
There we are. Yeah, did you fall for that one also? Can you relate? And do you shy away from anything now having to do with math? Even when I mention the word math, watching you cringe in the audience, yeah? And I'm not just referring to school, because when was the last time you read a book about math, or a mathematician, or a story driven by numbers and statistics? It just doesn't get the same respect in the media as its scientific counterparts. But why not? Well, math, though, as my next guest will attest, is a beautiful subject, and it can be mind-blowing and elegant and joyful to puzzle out. You just need to take a different approach to learning it. My next guests are here to discuss math's image problem. And we have some actual math problems for you to solve today. So trust me, this is going to be fun. Let me introduce my guests. Joe Bowler is co-founder of ucube.org. She's also the author of What's Math Got to Do With It? And professor of math education at Stanford in California. Welcome to Science Friday. Right next to me is Steve Strogatz. He's author of The Joy of X. I said X. And a professor of mathematics at Cornell University in Ithaca. Welcome back to Science Friday. Jordan Ellenberg is the author of How Not to Be Wrong. Where was this book when I read him? And he's also the John D. MacArthur Professor of Mathematics at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Welcome to Science Friday. Let me begin with you, Steve, because when I was back in school, at least, it feels like you're just learning all these procedures, all these rules. Were we learning it all the wrong way? What's wrong with this?
It's true that math is often taught in a way that emphasizes procedures, working with formulas. And it's a shame because the subject is profoundly meaningful. When you see the connections to scientific things or even connections between different parts of math, and especially connections to our everyday lives, these are things that can really make it a lot more fun, and it makes more sense when we think of it that way.
Joe Bowler, you teach math. Do people get it? I mean, or do you have to change your methods, or what's wrong with it?
Well, we actually have a lot of evidence of what works in mathematics teaching, and it's not what we see in most classrooms. There's a huge gap between what we know works and what we see normally, and the gap is, as you say, it's often very procedural, drill, lots of rules. When we teach it as an open inquiry subject, kids do well, they love it. So, I teach math-traumatized undergrads at Stanford, and we teach this open inquiry math, and everything changes for them.
You describe that a little bit. What do you mean?
Sure. So we work on really visual math. We look at different patterns together. We investigate algebraic, functional growth. Everybody has ideas. We talk about them. They love math after that.
Well, you know what is interesting about math is that we are all taught that there's only one exact answer to a problem, right?
Not always right.
But that's what you're saying. Mathematicians know that you can get close to it. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be exact.
And some problems have more than one answer. And every problem can be thought of in different ways. I mean, that's what's overlooked.
Why aren't we taught that way?
Yeah. Why aren't we?
Why aren't we? Oh, maybe. Jordan, maybe you have an answer to that.
Oh, so why we do what we do. That's a challenge. I mean, Joe is absolutely right that the teaching of math is a set of absolutely formal procedures. Something like a game, right? Something like solving Rubik's Cube. I mean, there is some pleasure in solving Rubik's Cube, but we wouldn't make people do it for 6 straight years and grade them on it, right? I mean, people would sort of quickly start to ask why this particular sequence of formal moves. I think we lose sight of the fact that math is about real problems. And every piece of formalism you see, from a trigonometric identity to an algebraic rule, that was invented by people in the past who had a problem to solve and their life was better after they had the mathematical formalism than before. And I think we do often lose sight of that in the classroom.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, Ira. I mean, so the word algebra, which we've talked about a few times and which is often criticized as one of the driest and most dispensable subjects in the curriculum, actually, it's a great story. I mean, first of all, you can hear from the sound of that word that that's an Arabic word, right? It comes from al-jabar.
And wait, but then it's cut out of the curriculum immediately if you admit that.
Yes, okay.
So you have to be very careful.
But I mean, the point I just want to make is that algebra, you know, okay, admitting that, does come from a very practical, interesting problem. People in the audience, I'm guessing most people here will have no idea why was algebra invented around 800 AD. It actually has to do with figuring out how to divide up money among your heirs under Islamic inheritance law. So if a man dies and has money to leave to his sons and to his daughters and to the people he owes money to, first he has to, listen to this, you're going to hear where the algebra is. First he has to give a certain amount of money to these people that he owes money to. Then he has to give equal amounts of money to each of his sons. and it has to be twice as much money as he gives to each of his daughters. Hey, this is the law. And that is a problem with algebraic constraints, and to solve this problem and figure out who gets what, you had to invent algebra.
Well, if you told that to every kid in seventh grade, they'd want to know algebra immediately. You know?
Would they?
With all
every
their siblings.
Every boy, maybe.
What's that?
Every boy.
Every boy.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, actually, I may have undercut my own argument there.
And do we teach anything practical about Steve? Well, practical math, you know? When did you do an upstream, downstream problem the last time? Or that kind of stuff? Well, I mean, you never see that kind of thing in real life.
Oh, don't see it in real life? I don't know about that. I mean, I think some of us, my world is applied math, so I like to try to throw in practical questions. And I think there are quite a few good teachers around the country that can show the beauty of math, the importance, its practicality, but also its coherence. That is, you know, you might think it's only going to make sense to students if it is practical. And that's true for the minds of some people. But there are others who actually see it as a kind of poetry or art. And you mentioned in the intro about the beauty and the elegance. There's that side of it, too. And so I think a proper math education should show all of that, the practicality and the poetry.
Yeah, you know, my first experience with that was when I was in 10th grade in geometry. My geometry teacher said, I love math, and you're going to love math when you're done with this course. We all were laughing, of course. But he really just showed us the beauty of the geometry that was going on there. And Joe, you don't see a lot of that.
You don't see a lot of it. And, you know, a lot of the problems that we can use math to solve real problems, and great teachers do that, but what kids suffer from is publishers' textbook problems. They are nonsensical, ridiculous problems that kids know when they're stepping into the math classroom. It's like stepping into math land. Common sense no longer is needed.
Such as?
Baths that run at exactly the same rate every second, trains right. Going towards each other on the same track. Algebra problems are full of these ridiculous math problems. And what happens over time is kids think, math doesn't involve common sense. I'm just going to suspend my common sense.
Right, because the right answer to that question is, wait, stop, the trains shouldn't be going towards each other on the same track. Like, that's what...
And there's something to that.
Yeah.
Teaching it that way.
Right.
But let me mention one that was a real case, actually. This happened with me and my wife just recently. She's an artist and wanted to... work very big, as she put it. She had a canvas that was about 8 feet tall. Now, her studio has only a 7-foot ceiling. Now, she wanted it to be straight up against the wall, but obviously you can't put something that's 8 feet tall straight up against a room with a 7-foot ceiling. So she said to me, if I wedge it into the corner at the top, I know it's going to be tilted and it's going to stick out on the bottom. How far is it going to stick out on the bottom? Is it going to be really unpleasant to work? Like, will it only be 1 foot? Right, because it's 1 foot too long. Will it stick out 1 foot? I mean, maybe you can visualize it. If it was a tape measure coming down along the wall, yeah, then it would stick out one extra foot. But this is a rigid canvas. It's going to actually stick out much more than 1 foot.
Did you tell her she had to figure it out on her own?
No, she's asking me. I'm the math professor. But it turns out that's if you're following me, that's the Pythagorean theorem in action. It's something we all learned. Except maybe you never thought about it for a problem that an artist faces when she's trying to stick her too tall canvas into her studio.
Well, then why not teach more of that practical stuff instead of integral calculus and all kinds of things like that that people may never use and feel like, oh, this is just way over my head. I'm never going to understand any of this stuff.
That's a very good argument for that. There's a huge amount of the high school math curriculum nobody will ever use again. And if we were to actually throw out some of that archaic content, Keith Devlin talks about it as 400-year-old mathematics that we still have in there, that we probably won't need or use, then people could go into depth with the really exciting ideas. That would be a fantastic thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. I would want to push back on that. But, I mean, some of these things, for instance, calculus is as practical and as beautiful and important as any branch of math. So let's not pick on calculus.
No, calculus is good.
But you have to be able to understand calculus to see that.
That's right.
Yeah. But calculus
details.
You can
understand.
But it's true that, I mean, calculus is about moving objects. Like, we care about that. It's not actually about whether you can correctly differentiate a polynomial. That's just a language game. And I think, I mean, I don't want to make it sound too terrible. I think teachers do try, right? I mean, I think there is some, I mean, I actually, if you look at much older textbooks, I do think there is less pure drill. I mean, Joe, you would know this better than me, but I think it's Wouldn't you agree it's not as bad as it was?
In some places. There's been change in some places, but unfortunately a lot of classrooms, you could step into a lot of high school math classrooms and think you'd stepped into the Victorian age. The teacher mm-hmm. would still be up there telling you things and the kids sitting down, writing down.
So you're saying you didn't know that was an old tape that we listened to of the teacher? No. You thought that was today?
but the Jordan, the argument that people always say is, well, you know, math teaches you how to think. Doesn't teach you, can you learn some other way than how to think, than having to think with math?
I actually do think there is something special about the mathematical enterprise and doing things formally. I actually do think that that builds like certain kinds of reasoning that really are not accessible other ways. I mean, maybe if we taught high school kids like analytic philosophy or something, but imagine like what a disaster that would be. But of course, the challenge is to get buy-in from the students, like to give them reasons to feel like what they're doing is worthwhile. And one challenge, I think, is that kids are very diverse and very different in what they respond to. This story you tell about being moved by the beauty of geometry, you'll talk to lots of people who will think back on their high school math and tell you that, oh, that was the one time when I really got what made math beautiful. And you will talk to other people who will tell you, you know, it was really stupid geometry because we spent all year proving obvious facts about triangles that you could just see, and somehow we had to write this T-diagram and write all these steps, but it was obvious. And I think that almost everything in the math curriculum, even trig, guys, you're going to find people who are like, that was my favorite, I loved it, and people who hate it. So I think that's a challenge that the same approach is not going to work for every kid.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, here in Aspen at the Ideas Festival. And if you have a question in the audience, raise your hand. We'll get the microphone over to you. Some folks over here. Oh, we've got one right now. Let's go right here to the front.
You haven't mentioned the word statistics. And when I started my PhD program, I found out I had to take 3 courses in statistics. It almost made me stop because I never liked math. Mm-mm. I took the statistics courses and loved them mm-hmm. because I understood that it was for a purpose. Mm-hmm. I could use math to understand something. It made it clear to me. And I wondered if other people have that same kind of experience.
Mm-hmm. Sure, they're called statisticians.
Well, actually, today they're called data scientists.
Right.
But I'm like this gentleman here because I took engineering courses and I was really not understanding math. But until I got into differential equations and higher, that I saw math actually working. But I had to go through the weeds, Joe, first to get there. Can't we get the weeds earlier?
This is how our math education has been designed, that you go through these years and years of mindless drill and get all the formulas and methods until later in graduate school you can see the beauty of math. We can't keep going with that method because by that time, people have given up. They've said, I don't want to do this. So you actually can teach the fundamental important mathematical principles through inquiry, through engaging kids in an open task that involves them learning some mathematics, and then they're excited to learn it. So it doesn't have to be, you know, what you experienced.
I will say, actually, I think this has changed a lot for most of us who are grown-ups, even since we were kids. I mean, right now, I think the statistics AP exam, for instance, didn't exist when I was in high school. I think now about 2/3 as many students take it as take the calculus AP, which is one of the most popular. So that has hugely grown in popularity. I think one thing to worry about, though, is we think about probability and statistics, and we're like, oh, wouldn't it be cool instead of these like dry old 400-year cookbooky courses that we had these like cool new courses, which would be great, and they would be about data and real things. And the danger is that if we sort of leave our practices of course construction and curriculum construction and textbook construction the same, what we are going to get are courses called statistics, which function and look pretty much like the trigonometry classes we already have. And I can tell you, if you think like bad trigonometry problems are bad, take a look at bad probability problems sometimes. Yes. They are an absolute horror.
We have a question in the audience. I know we have one right here. Yeah. Yes.
All right. So I definitely agree with what you're saying, that math needs a revamp. But I do have a question. I've heard that there are studies that show that young students, in particular female students, when they were told before taking a math test that they were going to do well, they were expected to do well, they perform significantly better. So how much do you think also relates to having teachers be able to instill confidence instead mm-hmm. of the teachers themselves being afraid of math? How much does that play into this?
Joe?
Yeah, I'd love to answer that question. I mean, one of the biggest problems we have in our society is people believe there's a math gene or a math brain. We now have a lot of evidence that isn't the case. And actually, the neuroscience and the great new brain evidence shows that everybody can learn math to high levels because brains can change, grow, and adapt. But teachers actually communicate, and schools and parents as well, that some kids can do math and some kids can't. That has a huge impact on children. As soon as they get the message, there's somebody who can't do math, they turn away from it. So we do know that the messages given to kids through teachers, through parents, are extremely influential. And actually, if you believe that you can do math, it actually changes the way your brain works with math. That's how important those beliefs are. And, you know, it is unfortunately still girls who are being given the message that math isn't for them, even though girls achieve at the same levels as boys in math. That myth, and you reference this study, I think, if girls just fill out their gender before taking a math test, they underperform. And that's because that stereotype is so strongly in the air.
We have to take a break. We're going to come back and talk lots more with Jordan Ellenberg, Joe Bowler, and Steve Strogatz. And when we come back, we're going to give everybody in the audience a few math problems to solve. See if any of this has sunk in. So we'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow here at the Aspen Ideas Festival in Colorado. We're talking about math and whether math matters and how to make math matter more. Ooh, I got three M's in a row. Joe Bowler is co-founder of ucube.org. She's also the author of What's Math Got to Do With It, professor of mathematics education at Stanford University. Steve Strogatz, author of The Joy of X, professor of math at Cornell. Jordan Ellenberg, author of How Not to Be Wrong, and MacArthur, professor of math at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. We are now going to go talk about some of the math problems. I'm going to go to Joe first.
Okay.
You have a math problem. I'll give you a problem in the audience, and it's not going to be anything you need to write pencil and paper with, is it?
It might help, but you don't need to.
Okay.
So I'm giving you this math problem, and I should say before I give you this, this is not my favorite math problem at all. In fact, this is one of the type of math problems I don't think are great, but it shows something interesting. So we're going to say a man is on a diet, and he goes into a shop to buy some turkey slices. He's given three slices, which together weigh a third of a pound, but he's only allowed to eat a quarter of a pound. How much of these three slices can he eat and while staying true to his diet?
All right.
So this is a kind of classic math problem.
All right. We'll give you 15 seconds to think about it. And then we'll go and ask people to raise their hands and see if they have... I got this wrong. So just so
That's
you feel
good.
Better.
Mistakes.
At least one of us got it wrong up here.
Mistakes grow your brain.
The teaching clock is giving me math anxiety.
Mueller the buzzer if you're old enough to remember her. Have you got somebody over there? Yeah. Okay.
I'm going to go with Alexa. 2 1/4.
How much?
2 1/4.
And how did you get that?
You just increase the third to a full, and then a quarter to a full, and then you can kind of divide it before there.
Increase a third to a full?
To a full pound, and then a quarter
pound.
How'd
you do that?
You're going to take 3, which is
okay.
A third, and then a total pound would be 9 slices. Half of a pound would be 4 1/2, and then half of that would be 2 1/4.
Okay, interesting.
Ooh,
interesting.
Nice.
Anyone else? Yes,
Any
over
other
there.
Theories?
Becky?
2 slices.
How did you
two
get
slices.
That?
2 slices.
Well, if you had 2 slices, it's a quarter of a pound. If you have 8 slices, and you say, how many? 3/8 out of 8, and you take 1 off to get to a quarter, it's 2/8.
Someone in the back? We'll get one more answer and see if we can come up with the correct one.
2 1/2 slices.
And how did you get that? I love it. We have 3 answers already.
Yes. Well, 1/3 is 30%, I think, and 1/4 is 25%.
Okay.
And that's 2 1/2 of 30. 25% is 2 1/2 of 30.
Joe, what's the right answer?
The right answer is actually 2 1/4, or 9/4 is the other way of thinking about it. But I gave this problem?
Please.
Yeah, so how many people saw this problem and just felt horrible inside? Can I
see?
It's really hard to see out here, but so this is a kind of classic problem, and what's interesting about this problem is we've given this out to different people, and kids who've gone through algebra immediately, and parents will immediately try and set up some kind of algebraic equation of a third equals three slices, a quarter is x, and then they try and cross multiply, and it gets complicated and sort of tricky. We gave it to a 9-year-old, and she drew three slices like this, and she said, that's a third of a pound, so I'm going to make a pound. And so she drew nine slices like that, and then she just drew a cross in the middle and said, I'll take this quarter. So another very elegant way, which also came from a much younger child, and I was hearing some of this from the answers, was I have three slices, which are a third of a pound, so nine slices will give me a pound, and and I can have a quarter of that, so it's 9/4. Both of those methods don't involve algebra. They're visual and elegant methods. But we actually, unfortunately, when we put kids through a very sort of procedural math education, we knock that kind of thinking out of them often, where they think, I'm not meant to make sense of this. I'm not meant to draw a lovely visual. I've got to try and use algebra. So I use this as an example, really, of what bad math education really does for us.
Yeah, well, guilty as charged. all right, Jordan, you've got a question for it.
Okay, so here's a question, and Steve denies this is a math question, actually, so we're going to discuss also whether it's a math question or not. So here's a funny word. The word is ouroboric. It comes from the Ouroboros, the snake that eats its own tail, for reasons that will become clear in a moment. What ouroboric means is it refers to a word that describes itself. So, for instance, here's one, polysyllabic. That word actually is polysyllabic, so it's an ouroboric word. But a word that's not ouroboric would be, let's say, unpronounceable. Because, look, I just pronounced it, right? So evidently it is not self-descriptive. Like, it's not unpronounceable, even though that's the word. Okay, so here's, ready for the question now? The question is, the word non-ouroboric, is it ouroboric or not?
Is non-ouroboric ouroboric or not? Does it describe itself?
That's right. Does that word describe itself? So we can take a moment to wrestle with that.
Anybody want to venture a guess? Embarrass themselves in public?
It's only national radio.
All right, no takers on that. What's the argument you have with Steve? Describe your answer and Steve will have a rebuttal.
Steve said this is a philosophy question, and it kind of is. I mean, math and philosophy sort of mix a lot. Really, no brave people want to.
We have one over there. We have one over there.
Okay, that's
the shy
that's
people
the public
I
radio
about.
Audience. I expect. That's what...
Yes.
Yes.
The answer is yes. It's a monosyllable radio audience.
So now I'm going to push back on that answer. Here's the problem. The problem is that if the answer is yes, let's walk it through, then non-ouroboric is ouroboric, which means that it accurately describes itself, which means that it's non-ouroboric. So that's a problem for that answer. Anybody want to say no and see what I can do with that? So if you say no, thank you.
Inconceivable.
If you say no, then you're like, okay, great. So the word non-ouroboric is not ouroboric, which means it doesn't accurately describe itself, which means that it is ouroboric. And round we go.
So how is this a math question?
So how is this a math question? Well, this is actually a sort of version of a very famous event in the history of math called Russell's Paradox, after Bertrand Russell, the mathematician and philosopher. I've sort of taken it out of the set theoretic context in which he phrased it and put it in a more verbal context. But really what's going on is that you do something that seems very innocent, like making a definition of a word. Now, we know that in the English language, definitions are often a bit fuzzy, but in math, we believe that you should be able to make a definition and then follow its logical consequences. That does not seem like a controversial thing to be able to do. And what Russell showed is that that simple activity of making a definition and trying to follow its consequences actually could create unresolvable paradoxes. So at the time, there was a belief that we could reduce all of math just to logic, just to like a big pile of logical deductions from basic principles. A guy called Gottlob Frege was doing this. And when Russell sent him this paradox, it sort of led to it's sort of like the saddest sentence ever in the history of math. Like, Frege wrote back, having just finished this monumental two-volume book, he wrote back to Russell and said, just as the last stone was placed, the foundation collapsed. Like, his entire work. And we really, it sort of led to a revolution where he really had to rethink what math actually was. And we no longer think it's a simple matter of logical deduction from first principles.
We've gone through two of the three math problems. And Steve, you have one for us now.
I do. It's a question that was posed to me by my Uncle Irving when I was about 10.
Uncle Irv?
Yeah, Uncle Irv. So when I was about 10, Uncle Irv, who liked puzzles, gave me my first word problem. And let me give it to you. But I want to tell you, though, before I give it to you, that I got it wrong when he asked me, my 10-year-old self. And he actually laughed at me. And it made a big impression on me. I've never forgotten it.
We're here for you,
later.
Steve.
Excuse me?
We're here for you.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it's really embarrassing. I felt my face getting red, and I've never forgotten this problem. And so I want to give it to you, but I'm not going to laugh at you. In fact, I want you to guess, rather than the right answer, what my 10-year-old self's wrong answer was. Okay? So here's the question. It's one of these classic math problems, very artificial. It's a bathtub with two faucets that run at different speeds. Probably sounds familiar. So one of them would fill the tub in 1 hour if it was running by itself. The other one would fill the tub in a half hour running by itself. Now, the question is, if they're both running together, how long would it take them working together to fill the tub? Now, the question we want to pose to you when the timer starts going off is...
Give us one more time, repeat the question.
Okay, I'll repeat the question. One of the faucets can fill the tub in an hour. The other can fill it in a half hour. When they run together, how long will it take them to fill the tub? And what did my 10-year-old self say?
Oh. Wait. We need the little buzzer to make it kosher here.
Anyway. 2 hours?
2 hours. How did you come up with the idea that I might have said 2 hours?
I just... multiplied by the second tub because I didn't really get there's you're filling up one tub, then wouldn't you just fill up both?
Okay.
You can't laugh at him.
I'm not laughing at him. I'm enjoying the ingenuity of that answer, which I agree is wrong.
Any
does
other?
Someone else have an interesting wrong answer?
Are you going to tell us what you
no,
said?
No, not yet. We're going to exhaust the wrong answers before we do the right answer.
Okay.
I'm going to guess you said 3/4 of an hour, which is
3/4 of an hour, 45 minutes. Why would I? In fact, I did say that, and that's wrong. Why would I have said that?
Because it's the average of the two faucets.
Yeah, it's the average, right? You have two numbers, an hour and a half hour. You might think, if you're 10 years old, maybe I should take the average, 45 minutes. It's not correct.
Over here.
I'm going to say it's 20 minutes.
20 minutes. You want to tell us why you came up with 20 minutes?
Well, since it takes... half an hour to fill one, and then the other takes 1 hour. That means that the one that runs at half an hour is going to fill 2/3 of the tub, and 2/3 of 30 minutes is just 20 minutes.
Can we give a round of applause for that answer?
That
is actually the right answer. So Uncle Irvin gave me this hard way of thinking about it. He said, oh, Stephen, after he stopped laughing, think about how much each one would fill in 1 minute. One of them would fill 1/60th of a tub, the one that takes 60 minutes. One of them would fill 1/30th of a tub. And now you add them together, so they would fill up 1/60th plus 1/30th. Then you have to know how to do common denominators. So the 1/30th is 2/60ths, and that makes a total then of 3/60ths, which is 1/20th. Okay, so you fill 1/20th of a tub in a minute. That's 20 minutes per tub. I mean, 20 minutes for the whole tub. But I never liked that answer. I felt like this is all complicated with the common denominators. There's a really easy way to see it. If one of them can fill one tub per hour and the other fills a tub in a half hour, that's 2 tubs per hour. So together they fill 3 tubs per hour. That's it. That one tub in 20 minutes.
Ah. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. To what extent is math about explaining the right answer, not just getting the answer? Because, you know, when you always take a math test, they say, show us how you did it.
Yeah, I mean, what I like about this question, because you were asking us why do we think certain questions are interesting, as contrived as this question is, I think it makes the point that there can be plausible wrong answers. There can also be right answers that are better or worse. That is, we've heard a number of correct solutions here, including Uncle Irving's clunky common denominator solution, which is the textbook solution. But I wanted to emphasize that there's room for creativity. There's room for visual thinking about three tubs per hour and stuff like that, or the other solution that a person here gave with the different rates. Anyway, so I mean, I'm trying to push back against the idea that there's only one right way. There can be many right ways, and as you say, explaining it is part of the task. That is, math is not just about thinking and reasoning and answering, but communicating. Mm-hmm.
And I think done right, this experience that a student has, that doing a problem different ways invariably leads to the same answer, I think that's very revelatory. I mean, that's something that math has to offer mm-hmm. that other subjects don't, and that's special to math. That's quite amazing.
Say what you, I'm sorry, Joe, go
Can
ahead.
I speak to the yes. why do we explain? I mean, I have a lot of parents who say to me, my child can get all the questions right. Why should they bother explaining their work? And I say to them, and you guys as mathematicians can chip on this, but that actually explaining work in math is what in mathematics we call reasoning, where you give reasons for why you've come to conclusions. And reasoning is really at the core of the discipline. It is what mathematics is, where people reason their way, making statements to a proof. So to say we don't want people to explain their work because they can get quickly to an answer, as well as which it's in the explanation of the work that the rich, interesting pathways come out.
Yeah, we have one more question here. Yes.
Hi, I'm an engineer and my wife's a mathematician. And I've always thought that my kids would love math. I'm gonna teach them everything about math that I know and that they're gonna just grow up to love it. No matter what the teachers teach them in school. So what are the faults in that thinking? What are some of the traps that can fall into?
You're saying it didn't happen that way.
Well, I didn't learn that way, but what mistakes can I make to turn my kids away from math even?
Oh, I don't know about turning them away, but I can tell you in my house, I have two daughters who like to tease me about how much they hate math. And I don't think they really do, but be aware that they might play a game with you like that.
Jordan, do you have any experience with that?
I mean, this is the thing, you know, I have a 9-year-old and a 4-year-old, and I think about this a lot because I think they do like math, but I don't want them to feel like they have to like it because that's what their dad does for a living. So in some sense, I guess the potential pitfall that I see is making the stakes too high and making it so that, I guess I expect you to like math is okay. I demand that you like math. is probably, I'm sure you seem like nice people over there. I'm sure you would.
All right. Thank you all. We've run out of time. I want to thank my guest, Joe Bowler, co-founder of ucube.org. She's also author of What's Math Got to Do With, professor of math education at Stanford. Steve Strogatz, author of The Joy of X, professor of math at Cornell. Jordan Ellenberg, author of How Not to Be Wrong, and MacArthur, professor of math at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Thank you all for coming out and joining us today. That's about all the time we have. A special thanks to you and to Walter Isaacson from the Aspen Institute who invited us out here, and his colleague Kitty Boone and Jennifer Myers. And thanks to our friends at Aspen Public Radio. Yes, Carolyn Heldman, Tom Egan, Allison Bechtesh, Carolyn Zachariasen. And thanks to Kurt Lind, our sound engineer there at the back of the room today, and our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And we can't forget our Science Friday staff who made this possible. Charles Berquist, Jen Connor, Daniel Dania, Brandon Echter, Jennifer Fennick, Becky Fogel, Sarah Goldfarb, Luke Raskin, Christopher Intagliata, Jen Kwok, Julie Leibach, Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff and Annie Nero, Christian Scotta, Chow Tu, and Ariel Zitch. In Aspen, Colorado, I'm Ira Flatow. We'll see you back in New York.